We've only seen the surface of Uranus close up one time, and that was with NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft that made its flyby in 1986. It made a flyby of Uranus, it looked at a bunch of the moons, and then it was off on its way to do its encounter with Neptune. And there have been Earth-based telescopes and space telescopes like James Webb and Hubble that have been able to do follow-on observations, but still, one of the largest planets in the entire solar system has just barely been explored. And the planetary science community has been asking for and reiterated time after time that they would like to see a flagship mission to Uranus, in the same way that there have been flagship missions to Jupiter and to Saturn. So my guest today is Dr. Amy Simon. She's a senior scientist for planetary atmospheres at NASA Goddard. And she recently put out a questionnaire to the planetary science community asking for their priorities for what a Uranus mission would look like. What are some of the kinds of orbits, the priorities of the moons, atmospheric observations that they'd like to make. Now, this doesn't mean that it's a mission, but at least it's getting, you know, it's trying to figure out the parameters and understand what the priorities are for the community. And then that will eventually turn into a better understanding of what the instruments are going to be. And then those will help define what kind of a spacecraft it's going to be. And then that will help figure out when the thing's actually going to launch. And see, there's like a lot of pieces that have to come together. And so this conversation with Dr. Simon was about sort of how you start to crack that Gordian knot and try and figure out who wants what, when, by which place. And then what is the science? You know, what really interesting new stuff could we discover about Uranus and its moons by sending a flagship mission there? And in addition to our conversation about Uranus, Dr. Simon is also working on the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is now going to be doing a flyby and going into orbit around the Apophis asteroid that's going to be coming close to Earth soon, as well as the Lucy mission. And so we talk about all of those missions and just planetary science in general. So enjoy this interview with Dr. Amy Simon. Amy, it's been, well, I guess since what, 1986, since humanity has last sent a spacecraft close to Uranus, and then 89 since Neptune. What have we learned since that time that now we have new questions?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, I think the Voyager spacecraft, first of all, opened up our viewpoint of these planets way out in the solar system. And ironically, one of the events that really piqued my interest in NASA and space exploration was the Uranus flyby. In part because they were describing these really bizarre moons and, you know, the strange surface colors and so on. And, you know, then there was kind of this lull. We didn't go back. And so we've been limited to what we could do from Earth-based spacecraft, you know, Hubble, but also ground-based telescopes. And I think with the advent of adaptive optics on Earth telescopes, particularly in the infrared, we've been able to monitor these planets quite a bit. And while it hasn't fully changed our questions, it kind of changed our viewpoint in the sense that, you know, a single flyby, you get a very static view of a planet. You kind of think whatever is there is always there. And what we've learned is that's not really true. So we've seen the great dark spot on Neptune went away. In the meantime, we've seen new ones come back. But for Uranus in particular, tilted way over on its side, we're talking extremely long seasons. And so it kind of looked like a very bland light blue cue ball, for lack of a better word, from Voyager. But since then, we've been able to watch it change seasons. So we watched that polar cap really kind of disappear at equinox, and then the other one brighten up really substantially since the Voyager flyby. So the fact that we've had, you know, multiple decades means we've actually been able to see a bit of seasonal change on these planets.
But, you know, as interesting as the planet itself were the moons, and just some really extreme, interesting moons, has this ring system. I mean, I know we've seen some pictures from Webb and from Hubble showing the rings, but the moons, I mean, that, what do you get more than just a spot, right?
Right. It's hard to resolve the moons. Absolutely true, just because they're so small, so far away. But we have been able to take what little bits we can get from those point observations plus Voyager to learn quite a bit more about them. And, you know, scientists really will basically squeeze every little bit of information out of that one pixel that they can get. And I think also having Cassini at Saturn, we've learned that you can get very active moons even in these very cold locations of the solar system. So we're really keen to go back and look at the Uranian moons and see, are any of those active worlds, or could they have subsurface oceans like we think we see on Enceladus at Saturn and Europa at Jupiter, which is just kind of a crazy thought. I don't think we would have thought about that in the 1980s.
Yeah, it's funny. We've been reporting on this moon or that moon is now suspected to have a liquid ocean like Europa and Enceladus and Titan and so on. And this is just purely from archival data with a little bit of excess observations from Webb and Hubble and so on. It's kind of amazing how you're still making discoveries from 1986 data.
Absolutely. And some of that is better instrumentation. Some of it's better, you know, computing systems. We have computers able to do a lot more than we could do back then. And some of it's just better applying knowledge that we have from the Jupiter system, from the Saturn system, even from here on Earth, to understand what those geologic features on the surface might be telling us about what's below the surface.
Now, at the last decadal survey for planetary science, astronomers expressed a strong preference for a bunch of missions. For here in the solar system, they wanted to see a Uranus flagship mission. But, you know, there weren't a lot of details. I've reported on various, you know, variants coming out of, you know, different groups on what that might look like. You completed a new survey where you reached out to the astronomical community and said, okay, you know, like, let's see your order. What would you like? What is the sort of consensus that you're seeing from the astronomical community about a Uranus flagship mission?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And, you know, you have to remember that during a decadal survey, we have a very limited time period to work on this and a very limited group of people. And so what you end up getting out of the decadal is a very broad brush mission that, generally speaking, closes. We can fit it within the mass and the power constraints. But there's not a lot of detail below that. And that's on purpose, because that isn't your final mission design. And so what our poll was meant to do was not to revisit the science, right? We know we want to send a probe into the atmosphere. We know we want to explore those moons. Instead, it was to look at, you know, whatever your specific science interest is, and what is the key most important part of the mission for you. And again, we don't mean a specific science measurement, but we're thinking about this more like what Cassini had to do. So Cassini had 12 instruments on it, lots of science disciplines. Everything still had to fit. And so we broke down the orbits around Saturn into segments, and parts of them would go to study the magnetosphere, parts to study a moon, and so on. And so basically we were asking folks to, okay, you study the magnetosphere, which part of a tour is the most important to you? And of course, for satellites, getting as close as possible to those moons is going to be the most important thing. And that's not a surprise to anybody. But it was kind of trying to see, okay, how does that overlap with what the magnetosphere people want? How does that overlap with what the Uranus people want, so that you could later on fit this all together into a tour and make everybody happy? So that was the goal of it. It wasn't to revisit the science so much as to see how one makes this all fit together.
Right, right. I mean, I can see that it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, which is which instruments, well, it depends on which orbits you're going to do. Which orbits you do, well, it depends on which instruments you've got. And you've got to be able to sort of make those variables fit together. So it's interesting to me. When I think about the Cassini mission, you had various farther orbits, and then eventually it started to get a little bit more aggressive about seeing the moons. And then as it was really nearing the end of its lifetime, it started to make those plunges right down into the ring system, and eventually was actually entered the atmosphere of Saturn. So how do you sort of untangle this Gordian knot?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so now we took all those objectives of the decadal and let the community have at it and said, what do you want? And so what you have to do is kind of take a step back and say, what is the highest priority for each community first? And then see how you can shoehorn that together. And so let's say everybody wants that distant orbit. Then that'll tell you that, okay, we can't fit everybody in one orbit. We need to have 10 orbits or whatever to fit everybody. So it kind of also defines how long the mission has to be by figuring out how many conflicting objectives you have. Now, when you look at, again, we don't know the instruments. So this is people with their own kind of internal bias, whatever it is they want, trying to look at that. And it turns out that there really are kind of different areas that are important to different groups. With, like I said, some things that are no surprise, like trying to be as close as possible to a moon for satellite objectives.
Right, right. And they're not, you know, being very explicit about exactly what the science instrument is. Some kind of spectrometer, some kind of camera system, some kind of way to measure the magnetosphere, but not necessarily, you know, assuming that the best technology will be coming along and knowing that you're going to have a certain constraint on the loadout on what you can actually put into the mission.
Right, right. And I viewed this very much from, I was involved in Cassini at the early point. And when we were first laying out that sort of plan, there was a lot of strife over the fact that everybody wanted their observation first. You know, because we're impatient, but also people were semi, at least subconsciously worried that if I don't get it right away, maybe I never get it. And I think having had that experience and the fact that Cassini lasted so very long means everybody got not only what they wanted, but much more than that. And I think that'll be true of any mission, that once you start to lay it out, everybody will realize they're going to get their highest priority and probably, you know, several levels down from that. But until you start to lay it out, you don't really have a sense of what people really want or need either. So that was kind of the goal behind doing this. Understanding it's just a snapshot in time. Things may change.
So then how would you sort of classify what people were hoping for and asking for? What was sort of like some of the large scale segments of the mission that you would envision at this point?
So ignoring the atmospheric probe, because that's its own part that has, you know, it's typically going to be early in the mission. It'll do its relay. And then after that, everything frees up. I think what you find out is that for satellites, people want to get at least one flyby of every major moon. There's five of them. So that's a good thing to know. But we also ask, which is your top priority moon? So if you could get those five flybys, but then you could do a couple more and focus on which moon, which one would it be? And it varied a little bit by objective, but Ariel really came out on top. And that's, again, one of these ones that may potentially currently be an ocean world. So that one's of a lot of interest. Whereas going into it, I might have thought it was Titania. And that's because I don't do satellites, apparently. But it's and some people do want to fly by Titania, but we originally looked at that one as our tour driver. So the Decadal Tour had a lot of flybys of Titania to help crank that orbit around. And it turns out that's not as high a priority if you can find some other way to do it. So, you know, that was just interesting information. For the magnetosphere, you know, do you want to be on the day side of the planet, so between the sun and the planet, or do you want to be on the night side? And it turns out the night side is a little more important. And it has to do with those, you know, solar wind ions probably flowing down the magnetotail. But again, without that knowledge, it's kind of hard to pick those points. Atmospheres, it turns out you don't need to be super close to the planet. Again, not maybe a surprise to me because that's the area that I work in, but maybe it is to some other people. And that's that we like to be farther back so you can see the whole planet. You can make movies, you can watch the clouds moving and so on. And there's little subsets to that too. There's always other measurements people want. But trying to figure that out by objective, I think, is going to be useful information for grading what a tour design looks like against all the objectives and seeing kind of what's the sweet spot to meet the most of them.
Did anyone have opinions about the rings? Because those are one of the most interesting parts of Uranus for me.
Yeah, Uranus's rings are really intriguing to me as well. They're obviously not as thick and bright as what you see at Saturn. But as you mentioned earlier, the James Webb observations, those rings glow in the infrared, and they're pretty complex, and they reach kind of all the way down just about to the planet, as far as we can tell. So, you know, that image was important for two reasons. One, it showed the structure, but also it showed us it's really not going to be safe to do an orbit insertion inside those rings. You know, that was okay at Saturn, but not probably a good idea at Uranus. So that kind of changed how we are thinking now about what you'd have to do to get to orbit. But that also presents you a challenge. You do want to get close to those rings so that you can see those fine details. They're dark. They're a little bit more tenuous than Saturn. So to get that information is going to be a little harder. It's not going to be that visible wavelength reflectance. So yeah, there is a lot of interest in getting as close as you can to the rings, obviously, but there's also going to be probably some restrictions how close we can get because of the hazard.
Does the reduced illumination from the sun at that point start to have a big issue? I'm thinking about, you know, for example, with observing the moon, looking at the permanently shadowed craters, NASA developed an entirely different camera that's flying on the Korean satellite to be able to look into those in that low light performance. Does that kind of change how much time you need to make a lot of these observations with less illumination?
I think it's less of a challenge than it would have been, say, back in the Voyager days. And that's because we do have much, much more sensitive detectors and instrumentation that can see very, very faint objects. I think your biggest challenge is going to be dynamic range, because you need to look at very bright and very dark, you know, all within that same instrument, because the lit side's going to be brighter. But in general, less light at Uranus anyway, so I don't think that's a problem. I think the thermal instruments, on the other hand, have a bigger challenge, because it's very, very cold. And so to see thermal emission, you're going to have to be very sensitive.
Right. And so, I mean, are you going to be having to like block the sun like James Webb might, you know, has to? Or is it just that you're going to have to, you know, have a better instrument?
I think it's more on the instrument side, not so much like having to occult anything, because the sun is so small, so far away. Once you're on the far side of Uranus, you're just looking at the dark side of Uranus. So it really comes down to instrument investigations and deciding what science goals they're going after so they can optimize their instruments for it.
And that sort of leads into my next sort of range of questions, which is that, I mean, although you weren't specifically asking people about the instrumentation, I'm sure people are starting to know what they want. And it's an entire, you know, the last time we had a flagship mission that went out that far into the solar system, that was Cassini. We're decades since that spacecraft construction began and almost ended. Is it an entirely new world now in terms of what instruments are possible?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, that's the other thing to keep in mind. These very large missions can take decades of formulation. And if you look at something like Cassini, it was first formulated in the 1980s. So by the time it launched in 1997, it was already 20 years later. So you can see how you might be picking instruments that are already a little bit behind the curve, because they have to be built and everything else. So, you know, I think our technology is well past what we were thinking in the 1980s and 1990s. So it's an entirely new world, so to speak, in terms of instrumentation.
But I think about things like, say, the Europa Clipper. They were able to install a subsurface radar system onto it, which was a pretty big ask, a lot of both energy and weight to go into the spacecraft. Are there, you know, things that would have been considered impossible, say, back in Cassini's time, which now you could go, oh, maybe we could install this on one of these missions?
Yeah, you know, I think back in Cassini's time, we never would have envisioned solar-powered missions out at Jupiter, like Juno. Certainly not beyond. Now, that's clearly not feasible at Uranus, but, you know, I think the lightweight, low power instruments we've developed and that have flown now on Clipper, or they've flown on some of these other small missions, are really going to be game changers out here. So, you know, off the top of my head, I can't think of any specific one, but yeah, I think we're so far advanced from where we were that it's just not even the same game.
I've seen a lot of people proposing slimmed down versions of what would be a flagship mission, stuff that maybe would fit within a smaller class, maybe still even just a flyby, but with a more limited range of exploration. Do you think that, you know, that's a serious contender as a way to sort of get a mission going? Or do you think the community would rather wait for a proper flagship like Cassini?
Yeah, I think the problem, and we did look at this in previous studies before the decadal even, was that you get so limited on the science you can do if you just do a flyby. You end up losing all that satellite science. It's hard to do an atmospheric probe. You know, it becomes less of that big, large-class strategic mission the decadal was thinking of, and much more of a very focused, tiny, you know, small science return mission. And because it takes so much to get out there, you know, you're not going to be doing this a lot. So it's less efficient in some ways to do that smaller mission, because then you've left all that science still left unanswered. Whereas, you know, at least waiting till you can get the properly instrumented one and do the orbiter, I think makes a huge difference in terms of your science return. And that's what we found in the studies we did after the 2010 decadal, looking at this before this decadal, was that there really is a sweet spot where you have at least a solid set of instrumentation and an orbiter plus the probe.
Right. Yeah. And then, I mean, is there any way to get out to Neptune, or is the, from Uranus, is the, what was it? I forget what it was called. The Grand Tour. Is that
right?
Is that now over?
Yeah. I mean, that worked for Voyager because you had just the proper alignment to let you get those, you know, gravity assist and get on out there. And only Voyager 2 could do it. You know, Voyager 1 didn't. But that was very clearly just flybys. you know, you could not do the orbiters at both. You'd have to get back out of Uranus orbit and get out to Neptune. And they'd have to be kind of aligned, right, for that to work. So that's really a big ask. I think they really have to be separate spacecraft.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, Hall effect thrusters with fission, you know, like there's a lot of non-flight ready technology right. that would have to be considered to make such a mission work.
But when you get that warp drive working, you know, we're ready to use that.
Yeah, exactly. So then, you know, let's imagine it's a few years into the future and the mission is flying and you're starting to get the science back. What are the big scientific questions? Like you specifically focus on atmospheres. What would you love to be able to then have answered for you?
Yeah, you know, there are just so many big questions. So for Uranus itself, I think there's a couple. One is you've got this planet tilted way the heck over on its side. Something clearly happened during formation for that to happen. Yet when we look at models of when the solar system formed, most of the models have Uranus outside Neptune. They switch positions at some point. Everything has to be in the right place at the right time to make our solar system look like it does now. And so what I'm really looking forward to is getting the probe measurements of the atmosphere of the noble gases, the isotopic fractions of the different elements, including the noble gases, because that's going to pinpoint exactly where and when Uranus formed. And I think that's going to be critical for understanding our solar system as well as, you know, other solar systems. But on top of that, Uranus is still just weird. It doesn't have a lot of internal heat. You know, unlike the other three giant planets, and that's strange. Was that the result of a big collision? You know, we don't know. But this is also all based on a single Voyager measurement of that thermal emission from the dark side. So it'd be nice to get more than one. One point is not usually good for figuring out a line. So, you know, we'd like more data to understand what that thermal balance is on Uranus. And again, is this a product of its formation? We don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, the moons. Which I guess, what answers would you like to know about the moons?
So the moons are interesting, you know, coming back to this idea of ocean worlds and based again on that geology and that little information that we do have, it's thought that Titania did have substantial internal heat at one point. So there's a lot of investigations around that. Miranda is probably frozen solid at this point, but the two of them plus Ariel and Umbriel had potential ocean world implications as well. So I think getting close flybys, figuring out if there's any chance of liquid water below their surfaces, I think that's going to be really quite interesting and have profound implications for astrobiology.
Are there any hints? I know like Triton, there were hints of geysers when Voyager made its flyby, and obviously we've seen them at Enceladus. Maybe they're at Europa. Do you think that there could be any cryovolcanism activity at any of those moons?
You know, I wouldn't rule anything out, particularly since we can only see part of one side of each of them. You know, that, and if you look at Oberon, is really strange. It has this little polar ring, like an ice ring, little halo on top. Who knows what the other side looks like? But I think Ariel and Miranda, they have very strange geology. So I wouldn't rule anything out. I'd probably be wrong if I did. So,
yeah. So then let's imagine like best case scenario. When do you like, let's imagine that yes, this is going to go forward and there is going to be a flagship mission. And so when do you think this would be able to launch?
The nice thing of how we designed this in the decadal was we were very careful to try to keep it a little bit more constrained and not require huge technology developments. So the idea being that once it got a start, it could start anytime now and be ready to go within the development cycle. So you could launch in the 2030s, for example, because we don't require huge developments. That's not to say it's not challenging. It is, particularly because of the power constraints, but it's something that's very doable now.
Right, that the technological readiness level for everything that you're looking to incorporate into it has already been flight proven and is on Lucy or other missions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, I want to shift gears now and talk about Lucy because that's your day job, right?
That's right.
Yeah. How is the spacecraft doing?
So Lucy's doing great. We just completed a flyby of Main Belt asteroid Donald Johanson. And that was part of our initial mission plan. It was kind of a test run so that we could exercise all the instruments and how we'll do an encounter out at the Trojan asteroids. And everything went really well. So we're really pleased with how the spacecraft's performing.
And with that flyby out of the way, how long to actually reach the Trojan region?
So our first Trojan flyby is in 2027. So we're well on the way. We'll be doing our first distant calibrations starting at about the end of the year. So that's going to be the first time we kind of get out past the asteroid belt. So now we're just starting to get cold and it's really going to get interesting. But yeah, everything is going great on that spacecraft.
And then, you know, there's going to be a bunch of objects at the first Lagrange point and then fall back down, visit Earth again, and then go hit the other one. And so, like, I mean, I know they're all your favorites, but which of these objects, you know, or like what interesting things should people be watching for as these various flybys through the Trojan belts happen?
So the cool thing about this mission is it was designed to be this tour where we fly by a whole bunch of asteroids in the L4 swarm, or maybe it's L5 first, come back around near Earth, and then we cycle back out to the other cloud. And we can keep doing that every 6 years, actually, as long as the mission gets extended and we have fuel. So for me, I think I am on the spectrometer team, and these are each different types of asteroids, different spectral classes. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how much they vary, you know, how much their colors are different, their spectral features, how many of them have moons. It turns out a lot of asteroids have moons. We keep finding moons. So I think, you know, just seeing the variety in these objects is going to get really interesting.
And can you give us a sense of like of what that variety is? Like, you know, what are some of the types of objects?
Right. So our first flyby was Dinkinesh, this small main belt asteroid as well. That was an S-type asteroid. The one we just flew by is more of a C-type, which just means the spectral shape. We're going to be going by very primitive ones. We have P-types and D-types, which all mean different things spectroscopically. But, you know, to the naked eye, they're probably all going to be gray.
Right.
A lot of them are probably going to be a little bit potato-shaped or a little bit oblong. But, you know, when we're looking at it in detail, we'll enhance those colors. And you'll see some are a little bit more red, some are a little bit more blue. We're hoping to see areas on the surface, say a crater, where you actually see color variations, which might tell us different materials are on the surface. Or again, maybe things were exposed when something hit the surface. And for the ones that do have moons, we'll be interested to see if the moon is the same as the parent asteroid. So indication that perhaps it got broken off in a collision versus maybe something captured, which might be slightly different.
It's interesting. I know there's some research about like rapidly spinning objects are more likely to have these small moons that maybe they are calved off from them.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what we saw at Dinkinesh. When the first images came back from Dinkinesh, we had no idea what we were looking at because the moon was right behind it. And so it looked almost like it was touching. And it turned out that was just the viewpoint. But once we came around and saw the other side, the moon itself looked like it had two lobes. And the leading prevailing theory is that because it is spinning, material basically spun off, recoalesced into these moons and stayed in orbit. So that's why these spinning moons or spinning asteroids in particular can fling off material that becomes a moon.
But yeah. But having those sort of like double lobes, I mean, there's sort of two directions this could go, that they could be sort of tearing themselves apart and breaking off. But you also get all these contact binaries. Can you sort of tell the difference?
You can a little bit. Basically, once they can figure out the orbit, they can see if it's moving away from the moon or from the asteroid or towards it. And these contact ones, yeah, I mean, they're kind of very barely held together. And whether or not they have episodes of breaking apart and coming together, you know, I don't know. That's well beyond my field. But yeah, dynamically, it's an extremely complicated system.
Yeah, I think about the target for the DART mission, even OSIRIS-REx, but you know, a lot of these asteroids, they're spinning right at the very, like just before they'll actually tear themselves apart, and that boulders are sort of floating off the surface, migrating up, you know, and then they're no longer sort of have so much energy and sort of float back down and collect, and the thing is kind of redistributing. Like it's such a weird place out there.
It is. And you know, OSIRIS-REx Bennu kind of blew my mind that we knew it was a rubble pile, but when you're orbiting it and looking at it, you know, it looks like a solid surface. And when we touched down to take the sample, you know, we kept sinking in like a ball pit. You know, it really is loose collections of boulders and rubble that you don't think about when you're looking at it. It looks very solid.
So now we can talk about OSIRIS-REx. And you know, obviously we've got the sample home. So what is the next plan for this mission? Because it's still healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. So the samples are being analyzed and archived right now, but the spacecraft itself, when we released that sample return canister, we diverted the spacecraft so it didn't follow right in because that would not have been good. But it is completely healthy. It has fuel. And so what we've been doing is an interesting little journey to an asteroid called Apophis. And we've been calling this our trial by fire because to get to Apophis, we have had to pass close to the sun. We'll have to do it 6 times, much closer than was originally designed for, to basically come back around and line up with Apophis as it has a very close flyby of Earth in 2029. So everything on the spacecraft is working, but we're doing these funny celestial mechanics to catch back up to Apophis at the right time.
And like, how much before that flyby will it show up?
So Apophis is going to be passing basically between the orbit of the Earth and the Moon. So a tenth of the distance to the Moon, very, very close. It's going to be naked eye visible in April of 2029. And we will be observing it distantly at that point, and we'll kind of catch up, fly past it, and then rendezvous with it and get into orbit. So during that time period, there's going to be a lot of observers looking from Earth. There's a couple other missions hoping to go as well. So it's going to be quite the event in 2029.
Now, just going into orbit around an asteroid would be amazing. This one specifically, like, you know, most people know this is the one that was pretty high on the Torino scale for a little while until better observations brought it back down again. But what can you learn about being in orbit around an asteroid that's doing a close flyby of Earth at the same time?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to think about. So because the asteroid itself is passing so close to the Earth, we expect that there's going to be big tidal forces on it. So we might actually see some changes on the surface, like landslides or, you know, things being moved around just from the tidal forces of the Earth. And so that's why it's kind of so key to see it near that closest approach time. By getting into orbit, we'll be able to map out the surface. Now, this one is not a nice rotator. It's going to be tumbling. We know it's tumbling, but we expect that tumble rate to also change because of this close pass to the Earth. So it's going to be fairly disturbed by the Earth flyby. But, you know, we're going to be mapping that out and trying to learn as much as we can about the surface of this body and what might have changed from that flyby.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, you know, if you get many of these flybys over time, and, you know, they could speed them up, they could slow them down, I guess, depending on how they just change the distribution of material on the asteroid. And then that could be that, like, you could cause the trigger of one of these asteroids to break up down the road because it sort of got its shape changed.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what we've seen with objects that pass very close to Jupiter, you know, or the sun. So Shoemaker-Levy 9, the comet, passed very close to Jupiter, got broken into pieces and basically caught in Jupiter's gravity and sucked back in it a year later. In the case of this one, you know, this is very well modeled, but we still want to watch it, right? We still want to understand how it changes. But there's also one other force at play, which is a little tiny force, but it makes a big difference. And that's something called the Yarkovsky effect. And this is the case where these asteroids are heated up by the sun all the time, but they also get a little bit of pressure on them from solar photons. So the sun's pushing on them. But as they rotate away from the sun, that surface cools. And by releasing infrared photons, it gets pushed in a different direction. And it's this tiny little effect that can change the orbit by centimeters, but it adds up over centuries. And so that is something we studied on Bennu with OSIRIS-REx. It's something we'd like to study here at Apophis as well, because that can have a huge effect on what the orbit does in the future. So there's all these little forces at the same time, even though space is vast and empty, there's still stuff tugging and pushing on these bodies, you know, every day.
I know, like, Jupiter is constantly kicking asteroids out of the belt and in our general direction. And then they are spending this time, you know, as near Earth objects getting closer and farther from us. So, I mean, does this effect, the Yarkovsky effect, is that more significant than gravitational interactions with, say, Venus or Earth or Mars, Jupiter?
It depends. It depends how close any of those bodies get to Jupiter, Mars, Venus. So those bodies kicked out of the main belt. Some do become Earth-crossing, Earth-hazardous asteroids. Some become Mars-crossing. Some get kicked out entirely. You know, things kind of get scattered around the solar system. So all of these effects are in there. It's just a matter of if you have a gravitational flyby, that's probably the biggest effect. But if you don't, then it's going to be something like Yarkovsky.
And there's going to be another flyby of Apophis later on. Do you think, will you still be in orbit around it for the...
I'm not sure which one you mean, but there is...
Oh, then I'm wrong. Then I thought there was, maybe it already happened. I thought there was like, there was going to be a flyby that was going to get close, and then there was the flyby that people thought it was going to hit.
So that's right. Originally, there was going to be a close flyby in 29 and then hit in 36 or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. But that's been ruled out now. So 29 is the close flyby. There won't be a close one in 36.
Okay. So right. I'm even going to be as close as the one in 29.
No. The next closest thing will be the 2024 YR4, which also briefly ranked very high in the Torino scale.
Yeah.
That has now been ruled out of an Earth impact. But I believe, if I'm current, that it still has a slight chance of impacting the moon.
Yeah, so, I think it was 1% last time I looked.
Yeah, and that was, I think, 2032.
Right. But there was sort of this interesting, you know, various people were starting to go, like, how do we put together an interceptor? Do we, you know, I don't know if, you know, did those conversations go very far at NASA or any of them?
I can't speak to what the Planetary Defense Office did, but you know, obviously a lot of people put thought into these things. And it was even mentioned in our decadal survey that it would be interesting to have the capability of a fast interceptor. Also for these strange interstellar rocks that sometimes fly through. But, you know, it's challenging to get something off the ground quickly. Particularly if something is flying by really fast. So there are technical challenges with doing that. And, you know, one of the things we'd like to do with this Apophis mission is to see what it takes to get some of these other missions off the ground in time. So ESA has a mission called Ramses that they're going to be launching as well. You know, time's getting short. It's 2025 now. So we've only got a couple of years. So it is an interesting technological challenge about how could you react quickly?
Yeah. I think when Vera Rubin comes online in, you know, like a month, 2 months, then we're going to start to find out just how much stuff there is out there. I think it's going to be surprising. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, they're going to be a little nervous that this much stuff is flying past our planet. But I think for astronomers, planetary scientists, they'll be like, I want to explore it all.
Right.
You know, and especially these interstellar objects that, you know, they were just a fluke that we saw the two that we've seen so far. But In theory, we're going to find hundreds, maybe even thousands over time.
Right. And partly we're seeing them now because we have these great all sky surveys and we have these telescopes online. You know, we don't know how many we've missed over the years. Right.
Yeah.
There's probably lots of things that flew through the solar system so fast we never knew about them.
Yeah. Like if you get a flyby of or an orbiter around an interstellar object, that'd be all right.
That'd be pretty cool.
Or a sample return. Yeah, that'd be great. Amy, what are you obsessed with right now?
So, you know, I do a lot of things in the solar system. I am pretty obsessed with Uranus at the moment, but also Jupiter. We've been tracking the Great Red Spot now, even in my career, over 20 years. And just watching how it's changed in my lifetime is pretty cool. And I think, if nothing else, my career has taught me that nothing stays the same. Everything keeps changing in our solar system. It's very dynamic. And there's always something new to learn. You know, even something we've studied for 20 years is always changing. So that's what keeps me busy.
So is, you know, where do you fall on the Jupiter's red spot theory that, you know, it's been around since they saw it hundreds of years ago, or that this is a different spot? And how long do you think it's going to last?
My personal research would say it's a different spot, that we have very good records back into the mid-1800s, and it was far bigger than what was seen in the 1600s when the first telescopes were really being used. So it doesn't seem to me like it's the same spot. But I've been heavily involved with the work watching it shrink. And my personal thought is that it's going to get to kind of a stable point. It's currently too big for where it's sitting on the planet. I think it'll shrink down till it's a nice stable spot, and it's going to roll around at that latitude for a long time then.
Right. But still red? Because I know those are like the smaller white ones.
That is true. Most of the spots are white, and we did have one that briefly turned red. So that's an interesting question. It'll probably be a weaker storm at that point. So there is the potential that those white clouds might dominate.
But, and I mean, is it possible that it's just a permanent feature on the planet, that there's something about its dynamics sort of demands an event?
Right. It's a lot of it. This is internal heat that's coming up from the interior. Why you'd preferentially have one spot that gets it a lot is really hard to explain, unless there is some really strange thing going on way down at the core that's reflected up higher in the atmosphere. So now I tend to think of it more as just a stable storm. And we don't think that way here on Earth because, luckily, hurricanes and cyclones and even high pressure systems don't last that long. But these high pressure systems on the outer planets are much more stable, especially when they are locked at a latitude like the Great Red Spot.
Right. No continents to run into.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's absolutely fascinating. You've got a lot of work ahead of you. It sounds like a lot of science is going to be coming back very soon. And I know we're all quite excited to hear from all of it. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Amy Simon. I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Bailey Griffing, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Cy Nelson, David Gilton, David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hans Schultz, Hudson Moore, Jay Graves, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Mato, Paul Robach, Ring Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler Munley, Thomas L. Skadron, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. Well, as you can tell, I'm incredibly excited about the potential for a mission to one of the ice giants. If I had my choice, I think I'd want to see Neptune, and mostly because I'd want to see Triton and potential geysers on Triton, but I would be perfectly happy to see a mission to Uranus as well. Either way would be great. These missions take so long. You have to design them, you have to build them, but it's the flight time that you're looking at, this decade plus long flight to get all the way out there. And so we're not going to get a lot of chances to do this. And so hopefully that the will come together, the money will be made available, and this kind of mission will fly, and that we will get these answers. I would love to be able to see pictures of the Uranian system up close again. It's like one of my earlier space fan memories was looking at those first pictures as they came back in 1986. I was in high school at the time. And so it's time to go back. Now, we've got a bunch of other interviews about various planetary science missions here on the channel, so we'll put some links in the show notes. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time.